I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer.
This is The Road to Now.
Yes, it is The Road to Now. And man, the road for the last year. Bob, you remember last year we recorded the insurrection episode?
How could I forget?
That a lot of people listened to that episode. It was, I think, when of the episodes you and I did, I think it was my favorite. I mean, certainly heartbreaking thing that we were responding to. But overall, I think that there was so much there and we were able to get out. And we're now a little over a year out from that. And there's been a lot of talk about how will we remember it. And we're already seeing two completely different narratives just diverge on this. And so today's guest is the perfect person to speak to about this topic. Bob, you want to tell him who our guest is today?
Historian from the American History Museum at the Smithsonian, John Grinspan.
Yes, and he spends a lot of time thinking about these things, thinking about the way we've reflected over time. And so we're really excited to have him here. John Grinspan, welcome to The Road to Now.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm happy to be on to talk, even if it's about a, you know, unfortunate topic.
Well, John, I had the honor of meeting you a few weeks ago at the Smithsonian, and what's really exciting about your work is that you deal with history, but you deal with the artifacts of history. And the artifacts that you're surrounded by every day in your work, you're completely surrounded by all these artifacts of history. The more time you spend with them, the more time you gain a better understanding of the story that those artifacts tell. So maybe first, tell us what you learn from working with the artifacts of history.
Well, I guess the thing about working with the physical artifacts of history is they're kind of concrete proof of this world that existed in the past. That when we go to current events to try to preserve things for the future, or when we go through our archives or to other historical societies to try to hold on to things from the past, these are materials that really lived with the people who experienced these moments. And some of these moments, you know, things like the opening of the Civil War, these kind of really contested moments can feel to us theoretical, abstract, not human, kind of capital letters. You know, the Civil War begins now, World War II begins now. But when you see the physical objects, especially in my opinion, from ordinary people, people who campaign on the ground, who fought in wars, who experienced all these things physically in their lives, there's something that kind of builds in just a greater level of empathy than really almost any other way to engage in history. And so when you can see the physical stuff, the shoes people wore during the March on Selma, objects from torches, from parades from the 19th century, you can really imagine there's a human being here. And that's kind of, to me, the fundamental challenge of history is this is human experience in the past. And yet it's so distant that it can feel abstract or it can feel grand. And when you see the physical objects, it just feels human and real in a way that I think few other ways to get into history allow us to feel so connected to actual human beings.
You mentioned the torches from the 19th century, and that's what I think connects us in some ways to today, because a big part of your research has been about 19th century politics and the enthusiasm we don't understand. But take us that period between at the end, the close of the Civil War and the opening of the 20th century. What was politics like, and what some of the artifacts that those torches, talk about those torches and the role they played in the politics of the time.
I want to add on to this too, to bring it back to the January 6th thing. One of the things you talked about there is the ways you wrote this article kind of looking back from 2086. And one of the things that you really highlighted was we say history will judge this. We say, and we assume that there is a right side of history, make these claims. And you make this point that it could turn out any given way and that the narratives change at times. So talk about this 19th century and how that relates to January 6th and the way we might imagine it in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess starting with my own kind of realization of how I got into this, when you think of politics in the 19th century, you kind of imagine a bunch of gray guys with beards and a row of presidents whose names are hard to remember, congressmen who just seem so distant. And I started to realize first, through the turnout rates. I realized turnout rates were higher during this era from the 1860s through 1900 than any era before or since. So it's this question, what is driving this turnout? And you start to dig into the physical artifacts And you realize that political events are massive social events during that era, more than before, or certainly more than our own era or anything we can remember in the 20th century. So run a campaign in the 1800s means you get hundreds or thousands of marchers, you put them in uniforms, you give them torches, you march them through the town square or Union Square or wherever the kind of center of your community at midnight, usually shooting fireworks, shooting guns in the air, drinking whiskey, drinking cider, drinking lager, hollering slogans and rhymes and nasty jokes about the opponents. People are constantly counter-marching and counter-demonstrating against these. So if the Republicans are coming through town, the Democrats might, you know, be throwing bricks or yelling nasty slogans at them. It's really contested and really public, which means one, it's really tied up with culture. This is the biggest, these are the biggest events in the era, bigger than any form of entertainment at the time. So it really gets to the core of kind of popular culture and governance. They're mixed together. And it also enables people who can't actually formally hold political power to be engaged. So women who don't have the right to vote, African-Americans whose vote is contested, everyone under 21 who's too young to vote, they can still turn out for these rallies and holler slogans and feel socially engaged in politics, even if they don't feel, even if they're not enabled to actually cast a vote on election day. They still have a role in political life. And that kind of connects to the moment we're living in now. I mean, I started studying this era when these arcane torchlight parades, this kind of high level of engagement and enragement at the same time. And then you know, in our own era, you see things like Charlottesville. I attended University of Virginia. I pay a lot of attention to what goes on down there. And it was amazing to see, for me as a scholar of torchlight parades from long ago, people with tiki torches in the street in 2017. And we've only seen that amp up, this kind of way of building an engagement with democracy that is really heated and really avid at the same time, that you get the good and the bad, the high participation, the high interest. People talking about democracy is in some way a good thing, but you have violence, incivility, ugliness, fraud all tied up with it. So in a way, it seemed like we were seeing a return to this really arcane era that I thought I was interested in because it was so distant, suddenly became interesting because it was so relevant.
And that leads you to look at the period of the 20th century as being perhaps an aberration rather than the period before and the period we're entering now.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I loved about your work. You know, there's always that matter of confirmation bias, right? We like people who agree with us or say the things we've been thinking. We right now, and I've made this argument on the podcast before and in some of the things that I've written before, we right now, we're saying what has happened. We've diverged. Is America falling apart? And my argument has been, our baseline has been the mid-20th century, the post-World War II moment, which in almost every category is atypical. And what I love about this, you know, some of this work you've been writing, you've been making that same argument too, but in a very compelling way using politics. So could you explain your take on that and how it helps explain that as an atypical moment?
Yeah, and you can make that argument, as you say, in a lot of different ways. There's sociologists thinking about social connections. Jefferson Cowie wrote a great book. I know you're a fan of his. He wrote that awesome book, The Great Exception, about how unusual mid-20th century America is. And I feel it personally because I go to these political events and everyone says, this is not normal. And as you dig into the deep history of American democracy, our sense of normal is deeply abnormal. The idea of political restraints, civility being kind of the chief goal, the idea that you should keep your politics private and not tell people how you vote, the idea that being a political independent is better than being an intense partisan, these were invented in the 20th century and they didn't exist before and they're coming undone again. So I'm not trying to say this is normal, it's fine, we should just be happy to live in a chaotic political system, but we shouldn't act as if we're wandering off into some unknown thing. We have precedents here. I mean, the metaphor I keep thinking about, and I hope it's not too stark, is that we were raised in captivity, that we're like a cheetah who was raised in a zoo and is being reintroduced to the wild and saying to ourselves, this is really unusual. What the hell is going on? Really, a lot of politics for most of human history in most places involves tribalism, involves violence, involves a lot of contested aspects of it. That's not a good thing. We should work to get away from that, but we should also not act like it's the end of the world or totally unprecedented. We have tools and we have a history of how to deal with this. And I think the more we dig into that past, the better we are at dealing with this chaotic present we're in.
Well, then how did we, and to kind of play on Jefferson Cowie's phrasing, how and why did the 20th century become the great exception?
Yeah. And the good thing about that is a great exception is both good and bad, that some of the things they do are really beneficial and some of them are tragic, right? It's not yeah. broken, fixed, broken again. The answer is they built it, that political activists identified in the late 19th century big problems they saw with the political system, partisanship, violence, fraud. And those same activists were coming from these upper classes who saw another problem in the political system, that it was too democratic. Turnout was too high. Working class people had too much of a voice. Immigrants, African-Americans, young people were too engaged. And these reformers, and kind of many of them wealthy people in Northeastern cities, try to design a new way of engaging in politics, not just new political laws, but a new political culture that's all about restraint, privacy, independence. And on the one hand, it cleans up politics. There's less fraud. There are fewer assassinations. There's election riots are rare. People have faith in their democracy, but it also crashes turnout. You know, you have 80% turnout in the 1890s, crashes to less than half of eligible voters voting by the 1920s. A third of the electorate goes away for some reason. And that end of high turnout is tied up with this great exception of restraint and civility and stability. So I think we need to be really analytical and thoughtful about what we actually want and what the trade-offs are in reform. But we also have this model that reform works. It can be done, and it has been done in our past.
Well, I think it's fair to say here that some reason that some voters went away was because Plessy versus Ferguson allowed Southern states to segregate voting lines and then slow down Black voting lines. Shout out to Pippa Holloway on that. One of the things that fascinated me about the way that you talk about reimagining the past is that you have a lot of artifacts there. And you talk about the way that they play into the imagination of the Confederacy and the lost cause. And this alone to me is mind blowing, but I want to push it a little further here and ask you to talk about that. But then this question that I had, if we look at the 20th century, one of the big things that makes this the sense of unity or justifies this restraint is the Cold War, right? The sense that we all have this mission against communism. And within that, there's this idea that we have a united front. And certainly you can't explain civil rights legislation if you don't understand the Cold War. But at the same time, the Deep South locks down and finds themselves in a battle against the federal government and a battle for an imagined past that is really in many ways in conflict with this united front against the Soviets. So could you talk about that? And do you see in the collection anywhere where you can maybe a single item that really characterizes this tension?
I mean, I guess the item that comes to my mind first and foremost is a Greensboro lunch counter from the Greensboro protests in North Carolina in the early 1960s. It's not the first moment of the civil rights movement, but it's one of those moments when it really rubber hits the road kind of and gets a national audience and is one of the most successful ones. And so we have a big chunk of, you know, it's a lunch counter from a diner. So it's in segments, and we have a segment at the National Museum of American History. It's one of those objects that we've had on display just continuously or almost continuously for decades, because you can't put it away. It's too powerful. It's on the one hand, it's so banal. You can imagine ordering a hot dog at this lunch counter. And it's also this crux in American history of this fight over race and relations with the federal government and reform in America. And this conflict, as you mentioned, is happening right at the time when America is in some ways feeling the Cold War peaking. And, you know, real concrete fear of nuclear war, real fear of what's happened in Eastern Europe with expanding Soviet Union, not yet in Vietnam, but kind of the growing conflict around the world over the Cold War. And you can see the mixed tensions between wanting to have reform at home and wanting to present a united front. I think not to the same degree, but I grew up a little bit later, kind of maybe my undergraduate education happened during the Iraq War and right after September 11th. And there was also this similar sense that the real issues in American life were foreign issues or foreign affairs issues. And all the thinking people and all the writing people were writing about foreign affairs in the early 2000s. And that's what I started thinking about. And it seemed like American democracy, domestic relations, and how our own political system worked was on the back burner. And, you know, 20 years later now, I think most of, you know, the big think pieces are all about democracy with a capital D. And we're leaving foreign affairs on the back burner in a negative way in some sense, because the thing we want to argue about right now is internal democracy and our own political system. So you can kind of see the seesawing of eras. And that harkens back to the late 19th century when you read these newspapers, they have news on the wider world. And certainly America is building an empire overseas. But the thing they want to argue about is what happened in the next election in Sheboygan or whatever. They're so tied to their own domestic partisan political system that they have trouble engaging overseas or thoughtfully before the 1890s, even as they're building this large empire.
Now, with all this in context, talk about your op-ed in the New York Times that appeared after or on January 6th. And it's called, it's 2086. This is what American history could look like. Give us, talk about this op-ed and what you were trying to tell us all about history and historical artifacts.
Yeah, I wrote that op-ed with a colleague at National Museum of American History, Peter Manceau, who's a religion curator, and kind of kicked it off with this just almost an image in his head of the QAnon shaman who you remember from January 6th with the horns in marble in the Statuary Hall in the future, you know, next to Jefferson and Jackson and Washington. And we kind of started the ball rolling from there of all the moments in American history when something seems so blatant and clear and the moral judgment seems so obvious being recast over time, whether it's the, you know, nativists in the 1830s, whether it's the Confederacy or during Reconstruction and Redemption, the way history is constantly reevaluating and honestly trying to express a sense of humility about that, that there's a tone in the way we talk about history now. It's very triumphant and very motivated to right past wrongs, which is in a way great, but it's also important to remember how limited our ability is to control how people in the future will feel about us. And just how moving history is and how contingent and flexible it is. And I think historians sometimes need that reminder of, you know, we sometimes worship at the code of perspective and sometimes we let it slide, but remembering just how different our world will be in 100 years or in 50 years, just how flexible all these notions are. I think it's important to remember that because it makes us better historians as well.
One of the lines in this that hit me, and I actually like tweeted it out yesterday. I rarely do this, but it's like, this line was so amazing. As you say, no matter who wins the history wars, the future, the horrific attacks on the Capitol will likely bore school kids one day. Quizzed on Bunker Hill, the Compromise of 1850, the Battle of the Bulge, and January 6th, whatever that was, our trauma will be their homework. And in some ways, I wanted to save this for later, but in other ways, what I love about this line is our trauma will be their homework. I think this is the fine razor in all of this is to say that everything we feel will be subject to interpretation, even if that interpretation is that this is the most dull thing possible. And could you talk about an event that really drives this home?
Yeah. I mean, I think we all kind of know instinctively what this means. I love history. I've always loved history. You guys clearly love history, but you took tests in 10th grade where you just had to remember what the heck the Compromise of 1850 was. Yeah. And that's a crucial moment in American history that people were beating each other's heads over in the street at the time. Working on this book on late 19th century politics, some of the things they're fighting over after Reconstruction is over, after 1877, there's still mass political violence and uprisings over things like the tariffs, the money question, railroads, these things that seem pretty arcane to us. Now, it's hard to imagine a person caring about tariffs. But at the time, this motivated a lot of people who, some of them said, you know, I didn't care at all about slavery or race or whatever for 20 years. And now I care about the tariff. So just these things that felt so immediate to people at the time feel so distant to us today. And you can see this when you go through the archives in the Museum of American History, because we love our objects. We see that we believe they all have a special power. But some of them, you see something from the heart of the Civil War, you know, 1863 or whatever. Here's a good example. We have a watch that was owned by Abraham Lincoln, and the jewelers who maintained that watch inscribed little messages on it that were discovered much later. You know, slights on Jeff Davis and all these things. Really, really interesting, because it took a long time. It took 150 years for anyone to discover that those things were inside the pocket watch. And on the one hand, this is about Civil War. This is about secession, disunion, fighting in the streets between brothers. This is like as heated as it gets. On the other hand, sometimes you look at it and it's just an old watch. And you have to remind yourself how immediate and personal it all felt to people at the time. And so no matter how urgent things feel to us now, at some point in the future, someone will be bored by them. You know, I find being reminded by that. I'm not saying I love history. I don't find it boring, but there are people who will not connect with this, especially if we don't tell it well. So I guess the impetus is on us as historians to try to make this human and relatable and immediate and urgent, and hope that people will carry on the torch that we're passing to them.
you know, it's easy for us to laugh at the idea of the QAnon shaman or Josh Hawley from the night of the insurrection being immortalized in Statuary Hall. It's like we mock that and we laugh at that. There's no way. Talk about the way Jefferson Davis was perceived at the close of the Civil War and his redemption in the early 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Davis, General Lee, all these people, Stonewall Jackson, they led a secessionist, traitorous attempt to break away, and they killed more U.S. soldiers and did more damage to the U.S. Constitution than any other foe in American history, right? And you can find their statues all over the country still. Some are taken down, but there are plenty that are still up. Nathan Bedford Forrest statues are still up, and he helped found the KKK.
Some buildings are still named after him. Some buildings on college campuses are still named after him. Middle Tennessee State University. Sorry, just had to. That's my obligation to say that.
No, and it's shocking, and it would have been shocking to a lot of people in 1865. I think we see these statues, and we think there was a consensus at some point that everybody loved these guys, and it's out of style now. But you know, the great majority of Americans, if you count freed slaves, freed formerly enslaved people, the people who fought for the Union, both North and South. You know, this was a minority view at the time. It's not like most people love Forrest in 1865 and we're just turning on him now. And you can imagine the Jefferson Davis statue that went up in Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol went up in 1931, I think. It went up in 1930 and was dedicated in 1931. You can imagine African-Americans living in Washington, D.C., working in that building, which employed a lot of African-American people who were either former slaves or the immediate descendants of former slaves, having to walk by a statue of Jefferson Davis every day. It'd be mind-boggling, except that it's all over the place. I mean, how many Jeff Davis highways are there in America?
Too many. If there's one, too many.
Yeah. And we published this and we started getting emails from people telling us we were trampling on American history. It's not as if there was a point when there was a consensus on these people during their lifetime and we're deviating from it today. These people were always at best contested and at worst traitors. So I don't see I think we should see how shocking it is that they ever entered our history books as heroes.
And this is really kind of at the heart of it. You know, when people talk about the Confederacy, you hear them say things like, well, this is what the people wanted. You know, this was the attempt of people to throw off the federal government. And just to 47% of the population of the Confederate States were Black enslaved people. 50% across the board were women who were never asked. And so these types of assumptions that people make, right? They lay out an argument. Well, this was about, you know, the people standing up. It's like, well, they didn't ask the people, not the bulk of them. And now we have this reimagined on the past. And this, what you just said gets at the heart of a question that I've been thinking about your work and why I admire your work. Because those of us who work not, you know, we're not journalists, right? We're not independent. You work for the Smithsonian, which serves the nation. I work for a university, which serves the state of Tennessee. And in doing those things, you have to care deeply about everyone because you can't do your job well if you don't think about the perspectives. But for you in particular, this puts you in a situation where your mission to serve can sometimes be in conflict with a narrative that someone has. And we know that like our imagination of the past is so much about who we imagine ourselves to be. So you're not just putting up exhibits. You have to carefully walk through and imagine how do you bring everyone from different narratives into a story. Can you talk about how you do that? And what's an example of something where you found a way to bring people in who might otherwise have been turned away by an exhibit or an object or anything like that?
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that because it's something we think about all the time. And not just me, I've all my colleagues think about this and stress about this. I officially became a curator of political history at the Smithsonian during the 2016 election. And the day the official hiring all went through, I was standing at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland watching Donald Trump speak on the teleprompter, you know? So it was deep end of the pool from day one. The job is to talk about politics with the American people without offending anybody or saying anything controversial. At first I found it really restraining in a way, but the more I've done it, I find that it makes me a better historian, that it forces me to set aside my own to question my own personal political beliefs, to try to maintain perspective, to struggle, you know, no one is objective. Obviously, objectivity is kind of not really achievable, but to strive for talking about history in a way that the full American public could engage in. The Smithsonian is a really unique mission as trying to engage all the American public across political views. I found the best way to do that, at least for me, and other people have found other ways who are more clever than me, is to really focus on the human beings who lived in the past. That it's one thing, you know, you will lose some people if you say we shouldn't have statues of Nathan Bedford Forrest anymore. But if you just focus on what Nathan Bedford Forrest was up to in 1866 or whatever, you can safely maintain the historian's view of the past, that we are trying to figure out who these people were, what they believed, what their significance is. They didn't live in 2022. All these people, you know, I'm lucky I study 19th century history. They're all dead. All these people have passed on. No one can come after you. No one can tell you you're wrong. But also you can maintain just enough distance that you can really try to be thoughtful and analytical about their significance and their role and the meaning. And try to keep that in the front of your mind. That doesn't mean that we should be dispassionate and we should let people who, you know, were deeply immoral actors off the hook. But we should also remember that our sense of what morality is just wasn't the sense of morality 10 years ago, 15 years ago, let alone 150 years ago, which is why writing this article with Peter Manceau was so fun, because it allowed us to say, well, how will people view us in 100 years? What do we collect today that will just have no meaning or totally different meaning in the future? Some things we want to collect, things that have so many references to now and are so kind of slangy and of the moment in 2022 that they'll be incomprehensible in the future. So we try to spend a lot of time thinking about how to talk about the past and the present and how to talk about our present to our future. And it's an interesting act of time travel.
Something that was interesting to me when I was at the museum was the idea of how you get these artifacts, how they come to you. And you had tiki torches from the march in Charlottesville. And you also had like a suit of a congressman who cleaned up the broken glass after the insurrection. So talk about how those artifacts came to you.
Before I answer your specific question, I just have to say, I don't remember ever having as enthusiastic a visitor to the museum as you, Bob. I mean, it's such a joy to meet people who love this stuff and who know so much about it. And, you know, I wish your listeners could hear you asking, what do you have from John Quincy Adams? What do you have from Martin Van Buren? Because usually we have to struggle to get somebody to care, to see how important Martin Van Buren is. And, you know, when someone who comes through the door who wants to talk about Martin Van Buren, it's like finding gold or whatever.
any door who wants to talk about Martin Van
Buren. I said, what do you have from John Quincy Adams? Because he's a recent he used to be a fascination of mine. Now he's I've reignited my fascination. And my son and my 10-year-old son goes, Daddy, I thought you liked Martin Van Buren. So
he's been listening. Yeah. That's good. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was a joy to show you around, to see somebody who's so engaged and curious and happy. Yeah. Yeah. And talk to your kids at the same time who were like really thoughtful and had great questions too, but are, I guess, 8 or 10 or whatever. They're not on the level of super fan history nerd. You know? So it was fun to try to do both at once. For your specific question, you know, we collect from tons of contemporary events across the political spectrum. So we'll go to Trump rallies, we'll go to Bernie Sanders rallies, sometimes in the same day. You know, we collected from the day after the attack on the Capitol, from just garbage left on the mall. People, garbage is gold for the Smithsonian. You know, people leave behind their posters, their shirts, their signs. Those tiki torches were collected by a friend of the museum who was in Charlottesville and grabbed tiki torches, grabbed shields, riot shields from the rioters. And those objects, they're trash, right? Somebody would have thrown them away. The tiki torch probably started its life in a Home Depot or a Lowe's, bought by these people, used in this atrocious event, and would have gone back to being banal and insignificant, except that it went in a museum and hopefully will be preserved and in 100 years will help tell this story. So we reach out, we try to be really thoughtful about what we collect, what views we represent, and who we seem to be giving a win to. We're concerned about seeming to endorse an idea. So we don't want Patriot Front or whatever to say, look, we got an object in the Smithsonian. That concerns us deeply. But at the same time, we have a responsibility to try to preserve this moment, try to let people in the future understand. And also, hopefully, by making it real and physical, it'll make it harder for people to lie and misrepresent this future. It's in the future that we, hopefully these objects will kind of point the way to a more accurate reading of history. But it's always a challenge, and we just try to do it in a nonpartisan, neutral way with a lot of perspective.
Because I'm just imagining you calling a friend in Charlottesville being like, hey, can you go go pick up some trash for me?
Yeah. That's pretty close to the secret of being a curator, right? You call people up and you say, hey, can you do me a favor? A lot of people, if you call and you say you're from the Smithsonian, or if you just go up to them on the street, most people, their eyes light up and are really excited to have their picket sign in with Abe Lincoln's hat. Some people look at you like you're completely insane. Some people want nothing to do with the Smithsonian or the federal government. But they're, you know, even across a political spectrum, with political rallies and events for many different views, most people are pretty good-hearted about trying to preserve the past, and they understand what we're doing, and they're excited and they want to engage. I've had many, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I've had many more good experiences than bad because people value history and they want to be a part of it.
Has there ever been an item that you know is out there and somebody has it and you've gone to get it, or you've requested it or asked for it, and they say, no way?
Yeah, that happens a fair amount. we were at a Trump rally in New Hampshire, and this guy had a hard hat that was emblazoned with all these symbols of the 4 years of the Trump presidency. And I asked him if he'd be interested in donating it, and he had zero interest, which is his right. These people are private citizens. They have no obligation to give us their objects. So we're lucky and grateful whenever anyone wants to participate. And if someone doesn't, that's within their rights too. And it makes you realize how many great objects from history never made their way to a museum. You know, the majority of this stuff is lost, it's garbage, it's thrown away, it lives in someone's attic or is discarded. And we're just saving the last little remnant to try to preserve this history.
Hey, Ben, in a different part of the museum I got to see that day, there's a Ric Flair wrestling costume.
Well, that's appropriate.
It's sitting in a drawer, and I asked to take a picture, and I was not allowed, which is fine, which is great. But I just wanted you to know that in the Smithsonian, there's a Ric Flair wrestling outfit.
That real history is being recorded there.
That's right.
Real history. That's amazing. By the way, John, I'd like to thank you for recording that statement about the hard hat. Because you know that guy tells people, he's like, man, the guy from the Smithsonian wanted my hat. And people are like, yeah, whatever, dude. That guy lies all the time. So that guy right there just got validated. Shout out to Hard Hat Guy, who can now play this for his friends. And the guy really did ask.
Yeah, sometimes people who actually do donate, they want me to email their kids and testify that, you know, people are excited. They love it. They made some object that should be preserved at museum quality 100, 200 years from now, with George Washington stuff, Martin Luther King stuff, Frederick Douglass, TR, whoever it is. And they want to tell their friends and their family. And that's cool. That means they're engaged. That's what we want.
Can I just say, I won a battle against my wife when we first got married to keep my boxes of Legos. And now that we've got a son, it's basically hundreds of dollars worth of Legos. I feel validated. But if they ever went to the Smithsonian, that would be like an even bigger win. So I could see a lot of emails needing to go out and be like, see, that's why I kept it. But
the curator who does toys says people are just constantly contacting him with their broken Legos or Playmobiles or whatever. So you might have to get in line, but
oh, well. Well, this gets back to a question that I wanted to ask again about this duty that you have. And to me, when I think about, the first thing I think of is like, if I had your job, I'd be like, that would be amazing. And then you think through steps and you go, it would be amazing, but it's, you have to trust somebody in that position, right? I mean, you can't just be that, you know, you've got qualifications on paper, because what you're doing is, as you said, you are making collections. And at the Smithsonian, every museum this happens, but at the Smithsonian in particular, you're making decisions about what matters and implicitly making decisions about what doesn't matter. And I wonder how you find the process for doing that and how often you think, should I have done this? Should I have done that? How much do you reflect on that? You know, because I can imagine myself laying awake at night going, oh my God, like, did I serve everybody? Do you go through that? And how do you mitigate that stress, I think, that would come from it?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely do. The only way we can try to, the ways we try to do right by the American people in collecting what really should be in a history museum is we have incredible colleagues, great curators with really diverse interests and knowledge and expertise. And we try to collaborate and work together as much as possible. We try to know our collections really well. So one of the things that helps get something in the museum is if it connects to what's previously been part of American history. So sometimes we'll go to an event and somebody will have some object that connects to something we know is in our collections from 1912 or whatever. And that gives kind of a through point to justification for collecting it. But we just try to be really scrupulous to work, to kind of be careful. I mean, we're part of the federal government, so we're fairly slow, we're fairly deliberative. We don't collect a ton of stuff. It might be surprising to hear this, but space is limited. In the political history collection, we have a little bit over 100,000 objects, but that's all of American political history is supposed to be represented somehow or spoken for in that collection. So we try to be really thoughtful and slow and engage and also not make enemies. I mean, these people are doing a service for the country by donating their personal property, which then may be used in different ways than they anticipated in the future. So we just try to move slowly and be thoughtful and do a lot of research on it. And that's the best we can do because no one can ever do it right. You can definitely do it wrong. There's no perfect way to do it. So we just try to be as considerate and compassionate as we can be.
You know, you've mentioned several times about going to events. Is that a Smithsonian coordinated concept? The idea, hey, this event's going on here. Let's get somebody out there. This is going on here. Hey, John, can you fly out there for 3 days? Is that part of the job? Or is that something that you guys do personally because you are historians?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain events that we have a history of going to for decades, like the conventions, like the primary and the Iowa caucus. And we've been going there for decades. And that is always really rewarding. But yeah, we'll hear about some protest. We'll hear about some rally and we'll have to weigh. We can't go to everything. Politics is even in the small sphere of politics. There are too many things to try to get everybody's picket sign in the museum. And then there's all of entertainment and all of medicine and science and work and all these different things the museum is supposed to be representing. So we try to be thoughtful and anticipate where we should go, what will have meaning, what will connect to past aspects of American history or the collection, and communicate a lot. But it's funny because I personally didn't get into history to talk to people. I got into history to sit in the archives and not engage with anybody. So now they say, all right, go out and you know, make small talk. So it's actually been a really fun aspect of the job, going to these rallies, going to these events for causes, you know, across the political spectrum. It's really eye-opening. And it has sharpened my skills, I think, as a historian, and seeing how similar views were expressed in the past, empathizing with people in the past, imagining how events looked in the past. I think going to things in the present just sharpens one's skills.
And then sometimes, John, you didn't get into history to talk to people, but sometimes people load their kids up on donuts for breakfast and come visit you.
Honestly, I forgot that any kids were coming that day. So you may have seen me do a big gulp as I looked at the tiki torch from Charlottesville and the riot shield. How do I talk to 8-year-olds about this? But they did such a good job that we are always happy to talk with kids.
All right. My final question for you. And this is because I'm pumped about history. I can imagine what it would be like to be like, I'm hired at the Smithsonian. Now I can go in the back and look at anything. And this is my version of working there. I go, now I can go in the back and look at whatever. It's like being a kid and being like, I work at the toy store. I can go look at the. So for you, when you got hired there and you got access to look at these things, what was the thing that like blew your mind? What was the thing that you saw in the back that let's say, what's one thing that you knew was there that you loved getting to see? And what was one thing that just totally surprised you in terms of the way that it struck you?
One of my favorite objects, and I showed it to Bob, and I like it because it's cool. And also it's the kind of thing that could have been trashed 100 years ago. They had these, when they did these torchlight campaigns in the 19th century, there's like a one-upmanship to have bigger torches. And eventually someone invents the flambeau torch, which is essentially a flamethrower. It's a tube full of explosive powder with a wick at the top and a little flue at the bottom. And, you know, they'd have a rally for the Democrats or the Republicans or whoever, and have 1,000 guys shoot these bursts of flame into the sky at night. And it wasn't even marked as one, but just going through our torches and our collection, you know, you look at this thing and you say, is that a muffler? No, it's not a muffler. Is that a pipe? And then you realize what it is and go to the newspaper collection, to go to the databases. And you realize that it's this thing you've been reading about for years. It's the physical object right in front of you. That that is always a cool feeling. That's incredible to figure out what something is. And, you know, we have good data. We maintain our collection fairly well, but that moment of, is that what I think it is really always incredible. What was the other half of your question?
What was something that when you went into the collection, something that you knew that was there that you got to experience firsthand that really was amazing to you?
Okay. I guess one is we have George Washington's christening blanket from when he was christened as a small baby. And I honestly, I'm not a huge George Washington fan. I don't dislike him, but I just never got that into him. And the christening's not that interesting to me, but just seeing this physical thing that once held this baby who grew up to be a person who, you know, helped form the country and was revered for the next 250 years, but used to hold an 8-pound baby or whatever. It's just one of those incredible moments where you realize that these people in history, these people on the coins and on the flags were real, were human beings, were babies once. It's just, it's such a cool object. And it's not something I thought I would like, but just seeing it, just, you know, your eyes open up and you say, oh yeah, this stuff is all real. This stuff all happened, you know? So that's kind of a cool feeling you get sometimes going through that.
John, you have a great gig.
Yeah, I hope I can keep it.
Yeah. One of the, I mean, I've got this other gig I do and it's a really great gig and you're the same thing. Like, man, I hope I can keep doing this, but you have a truly, wonderful, profession there and congratulations on all your success. And we need to tell everybody about your book, The Age of, I know you've written a few books, but The Age of Acrimony, which talks about that time in American politics between the Civil War and the early 20th century, and a particular family who are probably unknown to many people, but played a role in that period, and who really exemplify the excitement and the interest, what's really fascinating about that period, The Age of Acrimony. We hope that all our listeners would check that book out.
Yeah. Thank you, Bob and Ben. And right back at you. You guys have an incredible gig. And I always used to listen to this podcast while walking to the museum. And now, you know, I'm working from home, but it's people like you who we all work together to kind of build this public engagement with history that's just so robust. And I think so much stronger than it used to be because of podcasts, because of this public engagement. There are a lot of things we're not so optimistic about right now, but I really do believe people are more engaged and more thoughtful about history than they were in previous eras, the immediate eras. And so just thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you,
John. That may be the greatest compliment that Ben and I have ever received.
John, you know what? If you were to ask me the question, what's the most surprising thing you've ever found in the Smithsonian? I would say a person listening to The Road to Now.
We're human beings. If you kind of imagine these guys in lab coats or men and women in lab coats. No, I mean, you get this job because you love history. And when other people who love history are broadcasting it, and you know, you can have it in your earbuds all day long, why wouldn't you?
I think our goal is to connect people to history, right? And it's what you do every day. And we're honored to kind of do what we do, and honored to have you and people like you, John, on our show. So once again, thank you over and over again. And we hope that you'll come back.
Oh, absolutely.
And to everyone listening, if you want to read any of the articles we reference here, if you want to pick up a copy of John's book, all the links will be in the episode description. Just go to theroadtonow.com or look at the description on the podcast player you're listening to this on. Thanks. Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Text a link to a friend, share a link on social media, or take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. All of this helps us spread the word about our show. So if you've already done that, thank you. Speaking of thank you, now's the time where we say the special shout out to our supporters on Patreon, with particular emphasis on our Washingtonians. Thank you to Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams and Frank Edwards, and Daniel Hansen. To all of you, we are grateful. If you're enjoying what you hear on The Road to Now, you can join us there on Patreon too. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. There are extra episodes, bonus materials, and you can even join us for an upcoming trivia night or live recordings. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. Our patrons keep us going. For more on this episode and our podcast in general, please visit our website, www.theroadtonow.com, where you can easily search our back catalog and quickly find links to content. You're going to be amazed by that website. And you want to know why? Because it was designed by Charles and Destiny at Seven Ages Design. Go check those guys out. They made our lives a lot easier and made us look a lot better. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer and the editor of this episode is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening. Take care.